Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 398th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast.
My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor, and I'm the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta.
So, if you were following along the play sheet, the previous podcast, we talked about the concept of monoclonal antibodies, and we spent some time talking about three agents that were used to reduce risk associated with certain medical conditions and the impact that monoclonal antibodies had on that. And so what we wanted to do is just continue on with what we were talking about last week and talk about three other agents. And the difference in this podcast is that we'll be talking about agents that actually have an impact on symptoms versus being agents that we talked about for RSV infections, heart attacks and cardiovascular events, and fractures. So let's jump right in. And I'm going to butcher this name as well, but here we go. There is a monoclonal antibody called guselkumab, I think. G-U-S-E-L-K-U-M-A-B. How would you pronounce that, Mike? Ha ha, there you go.
James. I'd pronounce it as James.
Yes, good.
UMAB.
Yeah, James UMAB. UMAB. Yeah, I like it, yeah. So this is, again, a new monoclonal antibody that's being used in the treatment of plaque psoriasis. And this is a study that was published last year. It's called the Voyage 1 study. And they took 837 subjects with moderate to severe psoriasis and studied them over 48 weeks. And as in one of the previous monoclonal antibodies that we talked about, the drug company did an interesting thing and compared this agent to another monoclonal antibody, and in a cool way, also included placebo. Now, some people say you shouldn't include a placebo, but they only included a placebo for the first 16 weeks of the 48-week trial. So in essence, we have reasonably good data on what happens when you give guselkumab, adalimumab, and then placebo. So we have these three agents being compared head-to-head for 16 weeks, and then the people on placebo were switched over to receive the new agent for week 17 to 48. So I think you'd agree with me, Mike, that is a it gives lots of useful information to have a comparative and a placebo arm.
Right, and it's a well-designed trial, and the idea of the kind of rescue almost to exit at the end of 16 weeks, it's
the way you should do it.
It's a reasonable trial.
Yeah. And so there are two main endpoints that they looked at. They looked at PASI 90, which is a scale used to evaluate psoriasis, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And they also looked at quality of life scale. So the PASI scale is they look at it's a scale where they look at the erythema, the induration, and the desquamation. I think that's the way you pronounce that, with the percentage of the affected area. And I wish I could show you what the different PASIs look like. But a PASI 90 is where you get, roughly speaking, a 90% reduction in the baseline of where they were in the first place. So if you can envision a patient who has moderate to severe psoriasis and then roughly remove about 90% of that, you don't see complete clearing, but it is demonstrably better. And then there's also where you get to a PASI 100, which is, relatively speaking, almost complete elimination of the psoriasis. So that's one of the endpoints. And then they had a quality of life scale, which I think is really important because, you know, you obviously want to see, does it have an effect on the psoriasis, but what does that do to the quality of life? And in this case, there is the index that they use, and these vary from the studies to the study, but this one was a 0 to 30 with a higher score indicating worse disease. So these guys started at around 13 to 14 on a 0 to 30 scale of quality of life, and a reduction of 2 to 3 in that scale is considered a minimally important clinical difference. So those are the two endpoints that they looked at. So the first endpoint was this PASI 90 at week 16, and they showed that 73% of people on this new agent, that guselkumab had a PASI 90, which is not complete clearing of the psoriasis, but pretty much complete clearance of the psoriasis. It was 73% with this new monoclonal antibody, 50% with adalimumab, and with placebo, it was 3%. So that tells you a lot about what happens if we don't treat psoriasis, eh?
Yeah, it tells you it's a terrible disease. And then the quality of life, I think it also improved considerably.
Oh, yeah, and it's fairly impressive. So with the quality of life index, given that nothing really happened in the placebo group, the quality of life didn't change at all, really. It started at 13 and it was still there. Whereas both of these agents saw, roughly speaking, about a 10 change in this quality of life index, which is...
On a 30-point scale, which is... Yeah. That's massive.
Oh, yeah. And especially when, like I said, a minimally important clinical difference is 2 to 3, we're seeing 10. They started at 13 to 14. So it's almost back to normal, if you will, with this.
Yeah. And you can imagine on a pain scale, a visual analog scale of 1 to 10, or 0 to 10, where most patients for pain, for example, would say I'm 5 to 6.
Yeah.
I can't recall a study showing people getting to 1 and 0. I just can't.
Yeah, there's one. It's general anesthesia.
But it, you know, it's it.
They have difficulty filling out the form.
What does it matter? We fill it out for them.
I know.
They're so happy and content.
Yes.
No, but this is like a 10 point drop.
Yeah.
This is one of these ones that is going to make, in this case, the dermatologist, you know, sit up and take notice. And there's no wonder they, you know,
they advocate for the funding of these agents.
Yeah, there's no wonder at all. Like in and I think you probably have some pictures on the show notes or something.
Yeah.
Seeing these patients basically go from quite bad psoriasis to completely resolve psoriasis for some of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very motivating.
Yeah. And so if you do the numbers needed to treat, I mean, this agent was 70% absolute increase in the number of people who benefit. So that's, you know, an NNT of 1.5. I mean, it's as close as almost as close to one as you can get. And that's
these are outcomes that are like, it's equivocal. It's, you know, there's some of them that set the standard of 10% better. And this is pretty much resolved or resolved.
Yeah. So that is fairly impressive. Now, you know, to be Debbie Downer on it, there's two things, and it's not really much. I actually don't know the price of this agent. And I'm not actually sure if it's even on the market right now. But the good thing is that they looked for malignancies and coronary events, because we've talked about that in the past. They were less than 1% in both groups. Now, as you can imagine, Mike, there is no real, you're not going to pick up much of a signal at 48 weeks. So one of the caveats for all of these medications, and I think the FDA is relatively mandating, is there needs to be ongoing cohort evaluation of this. But let's even assume that this drug increased coronary events by 2%. Over the next 10 years. If I was a patient, I wouldn't care about that for the benefit that I'm seeing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I hear you. And this would be one where you would hope they wouldn't react to that kind of thing and pull it from market, but let patients choose.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble for the company is, even when patients are informed and they choose and they later go on to have something devastating like a stroke, some patients will litigate and litigate successfully. Yeah.
Or even a cancer, right? Which is even more difficult to tease out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because,
yeah.
So go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's unfortunate because it then, you know, becomes so costly to the company sometimes that they withdraw the product and don't allow us as consumers to make informed choices.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, it's so tricky. And the problem is, I don't know if you know this, and you're a healthcare provider, right?
Yeah, I play one on TV.
Yeah, I mean, people get heart attacks and strokes and cancer who are not on monoclonal antibodies. I know that's a shock to you.
Yeah, that came out of left field.
Yeah.
So
no, but you know what I'm saying is that they're going to get them anyway. So the problem is if you've told them that it could be this, they'll go, "Well, no one else in my family ever got this." Yeah, exactly. So it's very tricky.
That's the cost.
Yeah. So that's fairly impressive. So then there's a product called dupilumab, and You have a little bit of experience, if you don't mind my saying, for eczema, where you see about a 30 to 50% absolute increase in a scale used for eczema. It's called the EASI or EASI 50. And so it clearly does have some benefit for eczema, but I'm going to talk about it for uncontrolled asthma.
Right. So just to give some background for atopic dermatitis. So one trial, these two will publish in the New England. There is one in the Lancet that was published as well. And it was on the general change in the scale, like kind of the mean change in the scale. We're going to look at how many attained a certain outcome. So if you look at how many got a 50% reduction in their EASI score, it was 85% in dupilumab versus 35% in placebo. Yeah. So that's a 50% absolute benefit. Right. And the other study looked at a much harder outcome, and it was basically complete resolution, or almost complete clearance of their atopic dermatitis. And of course, the numbers weren't as good then, but it was 38% versus 10%. Yeah. So, 28%. Yeah, 1 in 4 getting complete resolution of their symptoms. And I was on this drug for a while. And I was one of those people who had that kind of remarkable outcome. But for some, it doesn't work, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly.
And I've tried other agents because my eczema is quite severe. I've tried other agents that didn't work, but yeah, these drugs can have. But so its effect on eczema is atopic dermatitis is quite good. But James, you'll tell us they tried to extend the market to asthma, and how did that go?
Yeah, so this was a study of 770 adult patients with uncontrolled persistent asthma despite using inhaled corticosteroids and long-acting beta agonists, which are sort of the two agents that I think if I had difficult to control asthma, I'd probably give a try anyway, especially with low doses. Had to bring up the low doses. So, yeah, exactly.
10
so,
minutes in.
Yeah, so in this case, they looked at four different doses over a 24-week period, and they looked at two endpoints, exacerbations of asthma, which is a useful endpoint, and then in this case, a quality of life scale, 1 to 7, where they all started at about at 4. And so the exacerbations they did show that these medications did reduce exacerbations. And they saw if you took this agent monthly, exacerbations went down from 25% in placebo down to 15% monthly. And then if you took it a little bit more frequently, every 2 weeks, it went down to about 10%. Now, the difference between 10 and 15% was not statistically significant between those two agents. So I can't say one was better, but at least again, it's suggestive that if you give a bit more, you might get a little bit of benefit. So you're talking about somewhere between a 10 and 15% absolute benefit in exacerbations. Interestingly, though, the quality of life scale, here's what's, these things happen all the time. In the placebo, it increased by just under 1, which would be probably right at the minimally important clinical difference. And with this new agent, or the monoclonal antibody, it increased it by about 1.1 or 1.2. So here's where it gets very tricky with a product like this, not for eczema, but for asthma, is that it does reduce exacerbations by about 10 to 15%. If you give it to people, on average, they will feel better, but it probably isn't because of the drug, because the quality of life didn't change or anything more, even though it went up in both groups, but it was not better with that agent. So that's where it gets very tricky and quite different than what we talked about with that previous one on psoriasis.
Yeah, or its other indication with atopic dermatitis, where it has a pretty, the trials indicate a pretty profound effect.
Yeah.
But here in asthma, and what's interesting is those are the symptoms in atopic dermatitis, but here the symptoms are measured through the quality of life study or the quality of life outcome, and they're not really any different than placebo, or not meaningfully different.
So
it's an interesting thing. So this drug does provide some some symptomatic improvement, but not necessarily something consistently for another indication, which is a similar, right? These are atopic conditions.
Exactly.
They're atopy conditions. So eczema, atopic dermatitis, asthma, and hay fever, if you like, those are all kind of clustered together often. And it works for some of that conditions, but not all of them, clearly.
Yeah. Okay, so the last one specifically that we're going to talk about is Erenumab for episodic migraine. And again, this came out last year. It was a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they looked at just under 1,000 patients, 85% female, mean age 41. And they had only about half had not had any current or previous use of preventive treatment, you know, the typical stuff that we see, the beta blockers and the tricyclics and so on. And they averaged 8 migraine days per month. So that's fairly impressive amount of migraine. I think you'd agree with that.
Yeah.
That's an unfortunate amount.
Yeah. It's a potentially debilitating, depending on the level and severity of the migraines, because most people think of migraines as quite, but we all have patients who have migraines that can function through the day. So it depends on the severity of them and all of that. And obviously that's the median or mean rather than, you know, there'll be some people who are maybe even having one every 2 days.
Yeah, no, exactly. So what they did is again, almost all of these drugs are, as far as I know, given by injection. So they got two different doses, either 70 or 140 milligrams of Erenumab, and they compared that to placebo. And, after 4 to 6 months of receiving this agent, their endpoint was a 50% or greater reduction in the mean number of migraines per month, which is a very typical endpoint that you look for in people who are getting migraines, a 50% or reduction. And what they showed is that about 43% on the lower dose got a 50% reduction, about 50% got a 50% or greater reduction in the 140 milligram dose, and an important thing is that about 27% got that with placebo. So we're looking at, roughly speaking, a 20 to 25% absolute difference in the number of people who got a 50% or greater reduction in the mean number of migraines per month. So again, certainly evidence of suggestion that it benefits people with episodic migraine. However, when you're looking at these sort of things, you want to put it into context, because remember, this is compared to placebo. And I can't tell you that this drug would be better or worse than other agents. All I can tell you is when you look at almost all the other trials that look at preventative agents and look at that response where we're talking about a 50% reduction, when you look at beta blockers or any agent that has evidence, the numbers are almost identical. Is that 45% respond to the drug and 25% respond to placebo. And it's almost exactly what went on with this agent. So certainly this agent is another alternative, but it doesn't seem to be any more impressive than what we've seen with other agents, which do have some effect, but they have their own unique side effects and so on. So I don't know where you put that in, but all we can say is that at least with this agent, about 1 in 5 benefit, which is similar to other agents, you'd really want this trial to be a head-to-head comparison, in my mind, of very low-dose beta blocker or very low-dose TCAs.
TCA, yeah, exactly. Because the effects that you're seeing, you're right, James, mirror that what you'd expect from other agents. So as you mentioned, with propranolol, to get a 50% reduction, it's 57% versus 30%. Very, very similar to what they found, except that maybe propranolol looked better. So why not have a head-to-head comparison? But maybe they didn't, because they didn't expect to do as well.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what goes on in the minds of people?
Yeah.
I don't know what goes on in my own mind. So I don't, thank God.
A team of psychologists working around the clock.
They have not found anything. So those are 6 examples that we've talked about, and I hopefully it puts it into perspective that, you know, when you're looking at these agents, there are some fairly impressive results for some, not so much impressive results for others. And I don't know if you guys were paying attention, but we kind of evaluated them in almost an identical way that we would for any new agent. The only caveat to this is the difference between these and many other agents is their cost and the unknown side effects. But you can argue that is for most new treatments.
Yeah, and the fact that there's lots of medicines that are delivered by injection, but these are, I thought I heard that one was delivered by orally, but the vast majority, if not all, are sub-Q injections.
Yeah.
And so there are certainly areas that they have dramatic and profound impacts, but even in those cases, not all patients. I mean, we've all had patients who have been on proven beneficial monoclonal antibodies mm-hmm. for rheumatoid or Crohn's disease or what have you, and didn't get a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have patients who've had profound effect from them. So it does span the breadth, but it does require us to examine them in a similar way because basically they're still just drugs. There's nothing magical about these agents other than their price is magical.
Yeah, exactly. So just very quickly, I thought we didn't talk at all about these agents for rheumatoid arthritis, which is one of the more common reasons where we see these being used. And I just thought I'd alert you guys to those two actually quite useful Cochrane reviews of these agents. So they both published in the last year or two. And the issue of where do these drugs fit in for rheumatoid arthritis is, you know, are they better than sort of like using methotrexate, which is one of the first lines? Do they add any benefit to methotrexate? And I'm not going to spend too much time going over these Cochrane reviews, but what I can tell you is that when you look at the sort of key endpoints that you look at in rheumatoid arthritis, this one Cochrane review looked at sort of two questions. Is there an advantage to adding a biologic to methotrexate for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis? And there's also some studies that look at comparing these biologic agents to methotrexate. So what did they find? If you look at the endpoints of ACR 50, which is, again, one of these scales that people look at for rheumatoid arthritis, it's a, you know, a 50% reduction in that scale. About 56% of people who got the biologic plus methotrexate got that improvement level versus 40% for methotrexate. So about a 16% absolute increase in if you use both of these together. Now, I'm not saying that means you start both of them together, but that was the difference that we're talking about, that there was an additional 16% benefit. And we showed, and if you look at an endpoint that many people consider remission, it went from 22% in the methotrexate arm to 37% in the biologic plus methotrexate arm. So you're talking another 13% absolute increase of adding in a biologic. So, you know, we're talking, if it's about a 15% benefit, we're roughly speaking at around a numbers needed to treat of around 7 for this to get and I think most people would say a clinically important effect from these agents for that. And the nice thing is there was no difference in withdrawal due to adverse events or serious adverse events in this Cochrane review. Again, these studies are not, you know, years and years and years in length. And then they also had another look where there were some studies that looked at biologics versus methotrexate. And to tell you the truth, when you look at the numbers, you really couldn't tease out that one was better than another when they did head-to-head comparisons of these agents. So that's what we know about using these agents for rheumatoid arthritis in people who are naive to methotrexate. Now, where I think a lot of people might start to consider these are, what about people who've had a failure to DMARDs, with most of the DMARDs obviously being, you know, the methotrexate type agents? Well, there was also a Cochrane review where they took people who had failed on these DMARDs and randomized them to either a biologic or placebo. And what they showed was about a close to 25% absolute improvement in the ACR 50. So not dissimilar to what we saw about adding in methotrexate, I think it was around 15%. But in this case, if you failed on a DMARD, you get about a 20 to 25% absolute increase in the number of people who get improvement from an ACR 50. Now, there was only one study that looked at remission, And so I'm actually somewhat hesitant to give you the results of that because it did show an improvement, but it showed a lot of improvement in both the placebo and the biologic group. It was only one study. The nice thing about it, again, there wasn't any differences in the withdrawal due to adverse events or serious adverse events and so on. But that's the data that we have for rheumatoid arthritis. And I'm sure you've seen patients who have had fairly impressive results from these agents and probably some people who haven't.
Yeah, exactly. So I've seen patients who get considerable benefit because of the addition of the monoclonal antibody, and actually I've seen patients who got considerable benefit from just methotrexate alone. So that does occur, although we seem to, well, some people seem to kind of forget that about what an important agent it can be. In helping patients because we've had it for so long and it's kind of become a standard in therapy that we almost forget it.
So that's just some of the evidence of effectiveness. Now, one of the biggest concerns, other than the cost, is the risk of infections and cancer. And so there have been a couple of recent reports that I could give you some information on. There was one published in The Lancet in 2015 where they looked at the risk of serious infections for these biologic agents in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. It was a systematic review and meta-analysis. And what they were able to show is there an increase in the risk of number of serious infections compared to DMARDs alone? And as with all systematic reviews and meta-analyses, you sometimes have to take the results with a bit of a grain of salt. But what they suggest is on the standard dose of these biologic agents, about 6 per 1,000 per year increase in the number of serious infections compared to DMARDs. So 6 per 1,000, so that's 0.6%. If you go to high dose, it's about 17 per 1,000 per year. So it looks like there is something there. But again, if I was a patient who had rheumatoid arthritis and I'd had a reasonable result or effect from these agents, whether it was a 6 or a 1.7, 0.6 or a 1.7% increase in the risk of serious infections, I think I would ignore that, hope I don't get them, but know that if I get a serious infection, it could be secondary to that. So I don't know that's kind of what I would do for that.
Yeah, I don't think there's much else we can add to that. Like these patients, when they get a benefit and it's one of those powerful ones, they're willing to accept this somewhat increased risk of infection, which is not huge, but it is likely something going on there.
And then the only other thing that I could find was some stuff with the psoriasis treatments, because obviously these people get these medications for years. And there were two publications in the last probably 8 months, both in the British Journal of Dermatology. And what I'm going to do is just give you what they quote, what they said about this. And they are saying, as with all of these sorts of things, there's important limitations to the studies that we looked at, and there remains a need for ongoing pharmacovigilance in relation to cancer risk. So that was the one of the first ones, one of the studies that looked at, or group of authors that looked at this in January of 2018. And then another publication in May of 2018 says the cumulative length of exposure to biological therapies in patients with psoriasis in real-world clinical practice does not appear to be linked to a higher risk of cancer over several years of use. So I think that what it tells me is that as best as we can look at it, it doesn't seem to do everything over, several years. And when we're talking about several years, we're probably talking 2, 3, 4 years. But as the other group says, we need to have some pharmacovigilance. And it's my understanding that that is ongoing. So, we will never have a great answer to this. And if these agents don't give you much of any clinically important benefit, I'd probably just stop them. But if you get the results that you might have seen with psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis, that's why these people are using them, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they're profound conditions with a high symptomatic burden.
No, exactly. So that's pretty much it when it comes to individual agents and some of the evidence around it. Now, just very, very quickly, there's a big debate going on about biologics versus biosimilars. And it's virtually the exact argument that we've been having for the last 157 years, and I'm exaggerating, of brand name versus generic. And in my opinion, there, when you look at brand name versus generic, there is not a shred of evidence if a generic company makes these products properly, and sometimes it's even the brand name comes in or making them, that they're any different. And if they were really truly that different, brand name versus generic for other medications, not these monoclonal antibodies, drug companies would have done the studies to prove that they were different, because you lose a lot of money when you have to go up against generics.
When you come off patent, yeah.
Yeah, when you come off, yeah, patent. Exactly. So the now, when it comes to generic versus brand name other agents, these drugs are, the drugs are identical. You can't actually do that with biologics, which is why they call them biosimilars. And so they, which is a great word. I mean, it's trying to be vague, right?
Bio, really, really close to,
yeah,
the same.
Exactly.
Didn't catch on, so they went with biosimilars.
Yeah. And so they are, for all intents purposes, the same, but they can have some subtle differences. And so in the molecule. And so the question is, do they produce the same response, and do they produce the same risk of toxicity? And also, and you may, I don't know if you've had this discussion with any patients, but the issue is, when you start these agents, should you just go right with a biosimilar because they're going to be typically less expensive, or do you go with the originator? And then what about if you got a response and then to the originator, and then are you going to switch? And I'm sure those discussions may have come up already, eh, Mike?
For my patients, no, because most of the prescribing of these agents have come from their specialist colleagues,
right. Yeah.
Sorry, from our specialist colleagues. But I have heard those patients who can't afford them, they talk about alternatives for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And because, you know, when we're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars, if they can be thousands less, it might be worth going to a biosimilar. So there is not a huge amount of information out there that gives, where you can definitively say that there's no difference. But so there's a couple of things, and these are just a couple of papers that have been published on this. There's been a systematic review of the published evidence for biosimilars for the treatment of cancer, and they, under U.S. law, at least in obviously in the States, a biosimilar is approved based on a showing that it is highly similar to an FDA-approved biologic product known as a reference product. So, you know, these things are tricky. There's been a consensus-based recommendation that was published just this year for the use of biosimilars to treat rheumatologic diseases. And I always like the way they quote these things. The participants were confident that biosimilars approved by authorities in a highly regulated area are unlikely to differ from their bio originators in clinically meaningful ways. Nevertheless, they said, clinicians must be the only one to decide whether to prescribe a biosimilar in place of a bio originator on a case-by-case basis, with full awareness of the patient, which I think kind of makes sense. Now, what I can tell you is that the approach to determining biosimilarity, it's fairly intensive. They must demonstrate that the biosimilar and the bio originator have the same primary amino acid sequence. There can be no significant difference in the charge isoforms, glycosylation, and other post-translational modifications or impurities. Do you want to expand on that, Mike?
Exactly.
Exactly, yeah. There may be some minor differences, but they can't critically change the attributes of the biologic. And the quote from this article is that subsequent clinical studies must demonstrate pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic equivalent, which is actually what we do with generic versus brand name, and equivalent efficacy in at least one disease for which the bio originator is approved, as well as comparable safety and no greater immunogenicity. So those are relatively high standards to reach. So I'm not going to be able to tell you that for sure they are as good and equally toxic or not toxic, but a recent review that looked at this says extensive data suggests that, you know, the act of switching is not inherently dangerous. And again, I love how people word things. It's not inherently dangerous. I don't care if it's inherently dangerous. I want to know, are they pretty much likely the same? Now, there is one trial that was published last year where they did switching. So this is kind of the most extreme example where you might find a problem. And this was a trial where they switched from the originator infliximab in people with Crohn's disease, spondyloarthritis, or RA or psoriasis. So it was a gamish of all of those different populations or the different conditions. And what they did is they switched from the original infliximab to a biosimilar, about just under 500 patients over a 52-week period. And they were unable to show, it was a non-inferiority trial, which is good. They were not able to show that they were able to show that they were non-inferior. So between the infliximab and the biosimilar, and there was no suggestion of safety or immunogenicity differences. So at least this one trial, a well-designed trial, showed for Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, spondyloarthritis, RA, and psoriasis, although in the psoriasis, for instance, it was only 7% of those patients, there was no sort of hint that there was any difference between the originator and the biosimilar. But this is just one evaluation. I'm sure there'll be more. But again, these are the sort of things I wonder about. If the companies really believed that these agents were different, you know as well as I do, Mike, they would do those studies, because the cost of doing these studies to the amount of money that they will lose to generics, there's no comparison. So I sort of leave it up to the originator to actually prove that they are better versus the other way around. I don't always do that, but in this case, I would. I don't. Would you do that?
It's hard to say.
Like, yeah, it really
these
is.
These drugs are so expensive. That is the problem with them. And so we are depriving people of really beneficial treatments based on cost. Mm-hmm. And we as a healthcare system can't afford to have everyone on these. Can you imagine everyone with atopic dermatitis on the dupilumab?
Yeah, yeah.
And evolocumab for heart disease and blah blah blah. We would go bankrupt. Yeah. There would just be no way.
But we're gonna have to deal with this, because, like I told you before, 30% of the new agents that came on the market last year are these monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah, so, well, they are a potential source of new and viable drugs for our patients. And we've talked about in some cases how they can have profound effects. So I'm certainly happy they're pursuing this. I'm just not happy with the cost.
Yeah, no, exactly. So what we've tried to do is show you over these two podcasts is that these agents certainly have some unique benefits. They have some unique issues associated with things like cost, the long-term side effects, and so on. I do want to reiterate that the six that we chose really are not, they're not supposed to be demonstrative of the entire group of monoclonal antibodies, but we just kind of wanted to show that the evidence requirements and the patient-centered requirements are exactly the same as they are pretty much for any other agent. You know, we need the placebo-controlled trials. We would like head-to-head comparisons of these agents. We need, especially for these agents, we need long-term follow-up cohorts to look for long-term potential problems with this. And the whole discussion about these agents, I think if you as a primary care clinician or any clinician has an appreciation for, you know, the magnitude of the effect, what we know and what we don't know, helps that conversation. It is not a black and white conversation. It is not an easy conversation. And often you might be going, well, why don't you try it, see if you get a response, and then we need to make a decision whether you're going to keep going on it. And, you know, I'm sure that happens on a day-to-day basis all over the country and all over the world. And hopefully what we've given you is just a little bit of useful information to help figure that out. Anything else you want to add, Mike?
No, and I think the six that you've chosen represent a broad range of the preventative and symptomatic treatments and those that have good benefits and those that have very marginal benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also good trials that were designed and ones that left us with more questions, like the migraine one.
Yeah, exactly.
So that, you know, I think it was a good breadth of sample in what's out there, and it just reiterate what you have said is that begs us to, or encourages us, that we need to view these the same as everything else and look at them critically with randomized control trial data.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I think we'll leave it at that, Mike, but I know you want to sell something. and I use the word sell in quotation marks, but it's capitalized and bolded.
Yeah. So, of course, the BS Medicine Conference at the beginning of May, but also just a reminder that at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, we are starting a webinar series that's going to appear over the lunch hour for Montreal, or sorry, for Quebec and Ontario. And those will be varying topics, but can range from debates to classic kind of webinar lecture type formats. And they are the first one coming up in November is on osteoarthritis.
Cool. Yeah. So that's great, because I think, you know, the more information you guys can get about this, and I know if you're at the helm of these things, they will be, there will be a definite focus on evidence, I hope. I'm sure.
I hope so too.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's always tricky, you know, when other people do things, but if you've listened to this podcast long enough, you know what to expect from when you go to talks and what to listen for, I hope. And so I hope that this has been of some value. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.